orbs sprang out of the north. In moments, black clouds seethed across the sky. Lightning ripped the air. Thunder pounded like a crushing of boulders. Then, out of the bawling sky, rain struck like a paroxysm of rage, hit with savage force until it stung. The horses lowered their heads as if they were wincing. Torrents battered the riders, drenched, blinded them. Mainthrall Lithe sent her cords scouting ahead to keep the company from plunging over Lansdrop. Prothol raised his staff with bright fire flaring at its tip to help keep his companions from losing each other. They huddled together, and the Blood Guard positioned the Ranahan around them to bear the brunt of the attack. In the white revelations of the lightning, Prothol's flare appeared dim and frail, and thunder detonated hugely over it as if exploding at the touch of folly. Covenant crouched low on Dura's back, flinched away from the lightning as if the sky were stone which the thunder shattered. He could not see the cords, did not know what was happening around him. He was constantly afraid that Dura's next step would take him over the cliff. He clenched his eyes to Prothol's flame as if it could keep him from being lost. The skill and simple toughness of the Ramen preserved the company, kept it moving toward Mount Thunder. But the journey seemed like wandering in the collapse of the heavens. The riders could only be sure of their direction because they were always forcing their way into the maw of the storm. The wind flailed the rain at their faces until their eyes felt lacerated and their cheeks shredded. And the cold, drenching stiffened their limbs, paralyzed them slowly like the rigor of death. But they went on as if they were trying to beat down a wall of stone with their foreheads. For 2 full days they pushed onward, felt themselves crumbling under the onslaught of the rain. But they knew neither day nor night, knew nothing but one continuous, pummeling, dark, savage, implacable storm. They rode until they were exhausted, rested on their feet knee-deep in water and mud, gripping the reins of their horses, ate sopping morsels of food half-warmed by Lilianral fires which Birinair struggled to keep half-alive, counted themselves to be sure no one had been lost, and rode again until they were forced by exhaustion to stop again. At times they felt that Prothol's wan blue flame alone sustained them. Then Lord Moram moved among the company. In the lurid lightning, his face appeared awash with water like a foundering wreck. But he went to each quester, shouted through the howl of wind and rain, the devastating thunder,
"Truel! Storm! For us! But he mistaken! Main force passes west! Take heart! Augurs! For us!"
Covenant was too worn and cold to respond, but he heard the generous courage behind Moram's words. When the company started forward again, he squinted ahead toward Prothol's flame as if he were peering into a mystery. The struggle went on, prolonged itself far beyond the point where it felt unendurable. In time, endurance itself became abstract, a mere concept, too impalpable to carry conviction. The lash and riot of the storm reduced the riders to raw, quivering flesh, hardly able to cling to their mounts. But Prothol's fire burned on. At each new flash and blast, Covenant reeled in his seat. He wanted nothing in life but a chance to lie down in the mud. But Prothol's fire burned on. It was like a manacle, imprisoning the riders, dragging them forward. In the imminent madness of the torrents, Covenant gritted his gaze as if that manacle were precious to him. Then they passed the boundary. It was as abrupt as if the wall against which they had thrown themselves like usurped titans had suddenly fallen into mud. Within 10 stumbling heartbeats, the end of the storm blew over them, and they stood gasping in a sun-bright noon. They could hear the tumult rushing blindly away. Around them were the remains of the deluge, broken pools and streams and fens, thick mud like wreckage on the battle plain. and before them stood the great ravaged head of Mount Thunder, Graven Threndor, Peak of the Fire Lions. For a long moment it held them like an aegis of silence, grim, grave, and august, like an outcropping of the earth's heart. The peak was north and slightly west of them. Taller than Kevin's watch above the upper land, it seemed to kneel on the edge of the Serengrave, with its elbows braced on the plateau and its head high over the cliff, fronting the sky in a strange attitude of pride and prayer. And it rose 12,000 feet over the defile's course, which flowed eastward from its feet. Its sides, from its crumpled foothills to the raw rock of its crown, were bare, not cloaked or defended from storms, snows, besieging time by any trees or grasses, but instead wearing sheer, fragmented cliffs like facets, some as black as obsidian and others as gray as the ash of a granite fire, as if the stone of the mount were too thick, too charged with power to bear any gentle kind of life. There, deep in the hulky chest of the mountain, was the destination of the quest. Kirill Threndor, Heart of Thunder. They were still 10 leagues from the peak, but the distance was deceptive. Already that scarred visage dominated the northern horizon. It confronted them over the rift of lands dropped like an irrefusable demand. Mount Thunder. There Beric Halfhand had found his great revelation. There the quest for the Staff of Law hoped to regain the future of the land. And there Thomas Covenant sought release from the impossibility of his dreams. The company stared at the upraised rock as if it searched their hearts, asked them questions which they could not answer. Then Quan grinned fiercely and said, "At least now we have been washed clean enough for such work." That incongruity cracked the trance which held the riders. Several of the warriors burst into laughter as if recoiling from the strain of the past 2 days, and most of the others chuckled, daring Drool or any enemy to believe that the storm had weakened them. Though nearly prostrated by the exertion of finding a path through the torrents on foot, the Ramen laughed as well, sharing a humor they did not fully understand. Only Foam Follower did not respond. His eyes were fixed on Mount Thunder, and his brows overhung his gaze as if shielding it from something too bright or hot to be beheld directly. The questers found a relatively dry hillock on which to rest and eat and feed their mounts, and Foam Follower went with them absently. While the company made itself as comfortable as possible for a time, he stood apart and gazed at the mountain as if he were reading secrets in its scored crevices and cliffs. Softly, he sang to himself, "Now we are unhomed, bereft of root and kith and kin. From other mysteries of delight, we set our sails to resail our track. But the winds of life blew not the way we chose, and the land beyond the sea was lost." High Lord Prothol let the company rest for as long as he dared in the open plain. Then he moved on again for the remainder of the afternoon, clinging to the edge of Landsdrop as if it were his only hope. Before the storm, Covenant had learned that the sole known entrance to the catacombs of Mount Thunder was through the western chasm of the Soul's Ease, Treacher's Gorge, the rocky maw which swallowed the river, only to spit it out again eastward on the lower land, transmogrified by hidden, turbulent depths into the defile's course, a stream gray with the sludge and waste of the White Warrens. So Prothol's hope lay in his southeastern approach. He believed that by reaching Mount Thunder on the south and moving toward Treacher's Gorge from the east, the company could arrive unseen and unexpected at the gorge's western exposure. But he took no unnecessary risks. Gravin Threndor stood perilously large against the sky, and seemed already to lean looming toward the company as if the peak itself were bent to the shape of Drool's malice. He urged the tired Ramen to their best cunning in choosing a way along Landsdrop, and he kept the riders moving until after the sun had set. But all the time he rode slumped agedly in his saddle, with his head bowed as if he were readying his neck for the stroke of an axe. He seemed to have spent all his strength in pulling his companions through the storm. Whenever he spoke, his long ears rattled in his throat. The next morning the sun came up like a wound into ashen skies. Gray clouds overhung the earth, and a shuddering wind fell like a groan from the slopes of Mount Thunder. Across the wasteland, the pools of rainwater began to stagnate, as if the ground refused to drink the moisture, leaving it to rot instead. And as they prepared to ride, the questers heard a low rumble like the march of drums deep in the rock. They could feel the throb in their feet, in their knee joints. It was the beat of mustering war. The High Lord answered as if it were a challenge.
"Melancurian," he called clearly, "arise, champions of the land. I hear the drums of the earth. This is the great work of our time."
He swung onto his horse with his blue robe fluttering. Warhaft Quan responded with a cheer.
"Hail, High Lord Prothol. We are proud to follow."
Prothol's shoulders squared. His horse lifted its ears, raised its head, took a few prancing steps as grandly as a Ranahin. The Ranahin nickered humorously at the sight, and the company rode after Prothol boldly, as if the spirits of the ancient lords were in them. They made their way to the slopes of Mount Thunder through the constant buried rumble of the drums. As they found a path across the thickening rubble which surrounded the mountain, the booming subterranean call accompanied them like an exhalation of despite. But when they started up the first battered sides of the peak, they forgot the drums. They had to concentrate on the climb. The foothills were like a gnarled stone mantle which Mount Thunder had shrugged from its shoulders in ages long past, and the way westward over the slopes was hard. Time and again the riders were forced to dismount to lead their mounts down tricky hills or over gray piles of tumbled ashen rock. The difficulty of the terrain made their progress slow, despite all the Ramen could do to search out the easiest trails. The peak seemed to lean gravely over them as if watching their small struggles, and down onto them from the towering cliffs came a chilling wind, as cold as winter. At noon, Prothol halted in a deep gully which ran down the mountainside like a cut. There the company rested and ate. When they were not moving, they could hear the drums clearly, and the cold wind seemed to pounce on them from the cliffs above. They sat in the straight light of the sun and shivered, some at the cold, others at the drums. During the halt, Morum came over to Covenant and suggested that they climb a way up the gully together. Covenant nodded. He was glad to keep himself busy. He followed the Lord up the cut's contorted spine until they reached a break in its west wall. Morum entered the break, and when Covenant stepped in behind the Lord, he got a broad, sudden view of Andalane. From the altitude of the break, between the stone walls, he felt that he was looking down over Andalane from a window in the side of Mount Thunder. The hills lay richly over all the western horizon, and their beauty took his breath away. He stared hungrily with a feeling of stasis, of perfect pause in his chest, like a quick grip of eternity. The lush, clear health of Andalane shone like a country of stars, despite the gray skies and the dull battle roll. He felt obscurely unwilling to breathe, to break the trance, but after a moment his lungs began to hurt for air.
"Here is the land," Morum whispered.
"Grim, powerful Mount Thunder above us. The darkest banes and secrets of the earth in the catacombs beneath our feet. The battleground behind. Serengrave flat below. And there, priceless Andalane, the beauty of life. Yes, this is the heart of the land." He He stood reverently, as if he felt himself to be in an august presence. Covenant looked at him.
"So you brought me up here to convince me that this is worth fighting for."
His mouth twisted on the bitter taste of shame.
"You want something from me.
Some declaration of allegiance.
Before you have to face Drool."
The cave whites he had slain lay hard and cold in his memory.
"Of course," the Lord replied. "But it is the land itself which asks for your allegiance."
Then he said with sudden intensity, "Behold, Thomas Covenant, use your eyes. Look upon it all. Look and listen. Hear the drums and hear me. This is the heart of the land. It is not the home of the despiser. He has no place here. Oh, he desires the power of the Banes, but his home is in Foul's Creche, not here. He has not depth or sternness or beauty enough for this place, and when he works here, it is through Urviles or Cave Whites. Do you see?"
"I see." Covenant met the Lord's gaze flatly. "I've already made my bargain. My peace, if you want to call it that. I'm not going to do any more killing."
"Your peace?" Moram echoed in a complex tone. Slowly the danger dimmed in his eyes.
"Well, you must pardon me. In times of trouble, some lords behave strangely."
He passed Covenant and started back down the gully. Covenant remained in the window for a moment, watching Moram go. He had not missed the Lord's oblique reference to Kevin, but he wondered what kinship Moram saw between himself and the land waster. Did the Lord believe himself capable of that kind of despair? Muttering silently, Covenant returned to the company. He saw a measuring look in the eyes of the warriors. They were trying to assess what had occurred between him and Lord Moram, but he did not care what portents they read into him. When the company moved on, he led Dura up the side of the gully, blank to the shifting shale which more than once dropped him to his hands and knees, scratching and bruising him dangerously. He was thinking about the celebration of spring, about the Battle of Soaring Woodhelven, about Children, and Laura, and Pieton, and Atiaran, and the Nameless Unfettered One, and Lena, and Triok, and the warrior who had died defending him. Thinking, and striving to tell himself that his bargain was secure, that he was not angry enough to risk fighting again. That afternoon, the company struggled on over the arduous ground, drawing slowly higher as they worked westward. They caught no glimpses of their destination. Even when the sun fell low in the sky and the roar of waters became a distinct accompaniment to the buried beat of the drums, they were still not able to see the gorge. But then they entered a sheer, sheltered ravine in the mountainside. From this ravine, a rift too narrow for the horses angled away into the rock, and through it they could hear a snarling current. In the ravine, the riders left their mounts under the care of the cords. They went ahead on foot down the rift as it curved into the mountain and then broke out of the cliff no more than 100 feet directly above Treacher's Gorge. They no longer heard the drums. The tumult of the river smothered every sound but their own half-shouts. The walls of the chasm were high and sheer, blocking the horizon on either side. But through the spray that covered them like a mist, they could see the gorge itself, the tight rock channel constricting the river until it appeared to scream, and the wild, white, sunset flame-plumed water thrashing as if it fought against its own frantic rush. From nearly a league away to the west, the river came writhing down the gorge and sped below the company into the guts of the mountain as if sucked into an abyss. Above the gorge, the setting sun hung near the horizon like a ball of blood in the leaden sky, and the light gave a shade of fire to the few hardy trees that clung to the rims of the chasm as if rooted by duty. but within Treacher's Gorge was nothing but spray and sheer stone walls and tortured waters. The roar inundated Covenant's ears, and the mist-wet rock seemed to slip under his feet. For an instant, the cliffs reeled. He could feel the maw of Mount Thunder gaping for him. Then he snatched himself back into the rift, stood with his back pressed against the rock, hugged his chest, and fought not to gasp. There was activity around him. He heard shouts of surprise and fear from the warriors at the end of the rift, heard foam followers' strangled howl, but he did not move. He clenched himself against the rock in the mist and roar of the river until his knees steadied and the scream of slippage eased in his feet. Only then did he go to find out what caused the distress of his companions. He kept one hand braced on the wall and moved the other from shoulder to shoulder among the company as he went forward. Between Covenant and the cliff, foam followers struggled. Two blood guard clung to his arms, and he battered them against the sides of the rift, hissing rapaciously, "Release me! Release! I want them!" as if he wished to leap down into the gorge. "No!" Abruptly, Prothol stood before the giant. The backlight of the sunset dimmed his face as he stood silhouetted against the glow with his arms wide and his staff held high. He was old, and only half the giant's size. But the orange-red fire seemed to expand him, make him taller, more full of authority. "Rock, brother, master yourself. By the Seven, do you rave?" At that, Foam Follower threw off the blood guard. He caught the front of Prothol's robe, heaved the High Lord into the air, pinned him against the wall. Into his face, the giant wheezed as if he were choking with rage. "Rafe, do you accuse me?" The blood guard sprang toward Foam Follower, but a shout from Morum stopped them. Prothol hung clamped against the stone like a handful of old rags, but his eyes did not flinch. He repeated, "Do you rave?" For one horrible moment, Foam Follower held the High Lord as if he meant to murder him with one huge squeeze of his fist. Covenant tried to think of something to say, some way to intervene, but could not. He had no conception of what had happened to Foam Follower. Then from behind Covenant First Mark Tuvor said clearly, "A raver. In one of the sea-reach giants." "Impossible." As if impaled by Tuvor's assertion, Foam Follower broke into a convulsion of coughing. The violence of his reaction knotted his gnarled frame. He lowered Prothol, then collapsed backward, falling with a thud against the opposite wall. Slowly, his paroxysm changed into a low chuckle like the glee of hysteria. Heard through the groaning of the river, that sound made Covenant's skin crawl like a slimy caress. He could not abide it. Driven by a need to learn what had befallen Foam Follower, he moved forward to look into the gorge. There, braced now against his vertigo and the inundation of the river roar, he saw what had ignited Foam Follower. "Ah, giant," he groaned. "To kill." Below him and barely 20 feet above the level of the river was a narrow roadway like a ledge in the south wall of the gorge. And along the roadway to the beat of unheard drums marched an army of cave whites out of Mount Thunder. Captained by a wedge of Urviles, file after file of the gangrel creatures jerked out of the mountain and tramped along the ledge with a glare of lust in their Laval eyes. Thousands had already left their white warrens, and behind them the files continued as if Mount Thunder were spewing all the hordes of its inhabiting vermin onto the undefended earth. Foam Follower. For a moment, Covenant's heart beat to the rhythm of the giant's pain. He could not bear to think that Foam Follower and his people might lose their hope of home because of creatures like those. Is killing the only answer? Numbly, half-blindly, he began looking for the way in which Foam Follower had meant to reach the ledge and the cave whites. He found it easily enough. It looked simple for anyone not timorous of heights. There was a rude, slick stair cut into the rock of the south wall from the rift down to the roadway. Opposite it were steps which went from the rift up to the top of the gorge. They were as gray, spray-worn, and old as native stone. Lord Moram had come up behind Covenant. His voice reached dimly through the river roar. "This is the ancient look of Treacher's Gorge. That part of the first ward which tells of this place is easily understood. It was formed for the watch and concealment of the betrayers. For here at Treacher's Gorge, Lord Fowl the Despiser revealed his true self to High Lord Kevin. Here was struck the first blow of the open war which ended in the ritual of desecration. Before that time, Kevin Landwaster doubted Lord Fowl without knowing why, for the Despiser had enacted no ill which Kevin could discover, and he showed trust for Lord Fowl out of shame for his unworthy doubt. Then, through the Despiser's plotting, a message came to the Council of Lords from the Demondim in Mount Thunder. The message asked the Lords to come to the Demondim lore works, the spawning crypts where the Urviles were made, to meet with the lore masters, who claimed knowledge of a secret power. Clearly, Lord Fowl intended for Kevin to go to Mount Thunder. But the High Lord doubted and did not go. Then he was ashamed of his doubt, and sent in his stead some of his truest friends and strongest allies. So a high company of the old lords rafted, as was their wont, down the Soul's Ease through Andalane to Mount Thunder. And here, in the roar and spray and ill of Treacher's Gorge, they were ambushed by Urviles. They were slaughtered, and their bodies sent to the abyss of the mountain. Then marched armies like these out of the catacombs, and the land was plunged all unready into war. That long conflict went on battle after death-littered battle without hope. High Lord Kevin fought bravely, but he had sent his friends into ambush. Soon he began his midnight meetings with despair, and there was no hope. The seductive, dizzy rush of the river drained Covenant's resistance. Spray beaded on his face like sweat. Foam Follower had wanted to do the same thing. Leap into the writhing allure of the gorge, fall on the cave whites from ambush. With an effort that made him moan through his clenched teeth, Covenant backed away from the look. Gripping himself against the wall, he asked, without apparent transition, "Is he still laughing?" Moram appeared to understand. "No. Now he sits and quietly sings the song of the unhomed, and gives no sign." "Foam Follower," Covenant breathed. "Why did you stop the Bloodguard? He might have hurt Prothol." The Lord turned his back on Treacher's Gorge to face Covenant. "Saltheart Foam Follower is my friend. How could I interfere?" A moment later, he added, "The High Lord is not defenseless." Covenant persisted. "Maybe a raver." "No." Moram's flat assertion acknowledged no doubt. Tuvor spoke truly. No raver has the might to master a giant. "But something," Covenant groped, "something is hurting him. He doesn't believe those omens. He thinks drool or something is going to prevent the giants from going home." Moram's reply was so soft that Covenant was forced to read it on his crooked lips. "So do I, Foam Follower." Covenant looked down the rift at the giant. In the darkness, Foam Follower sat like a lump of shale against one wall, singing quietly and staring at invisible visions on the stone before him. The sight brought up a surge of sympathetic anger in Covenant, but he clamped it down, clutched his bargain. The walls of the rift leaned in toward him like suffocating fear, dark wings. He thrust himself past the giant and out toward the ravine. Before long, the company gathered there for supper. They ate by the light of one dim Lilianril torch, and when the meal was done, they tried to get some sleep. Covenant felt that rest was impossible. He sensed the army of cave whites unrolling like a skein of destruction for the weaving of the land's death. But the ceaseless roar of the river lulled him until he relaxed against the ground. He dozed slightly, with the drums of war throbbing in the rock under him. Later, he found himself sharply awake. The red moon had passed the crest of Mount Thunder and now glared straight down on the ravine. He guessed that midnight was past. At first, he thought that the moon had roused him with its nearly full stare, but then he realized that the vibration of the drums was gone from the rock. He glanced around the camp and saw Tuvor whispering with High Lord Prothol. The next moment, Tuvor began waking the sleepers. Soon the warriors were alert and ready. Covenant had his knife in the belt of his robe, his staff in his hand. Birinair held aloft a rod with a small flame flickering from its tip, and in that uncertain light, Morum and Prothol stood together with Main Thrall Lithe, Warhaft Quan, and the First Mark. Dim shadows shifted like fear and resolution across Prothol's face. His voice sounded weak with age as he said, "Now is our last hour of open sky. The outpouring of Druul's army has ended. Those of us who will must go into the catacombs of Mount Thunder. We must take this chance to enter, while Druul's attention is still with his army, before he can perceive that we are not where he thinks us to be. Now is the time for those who would to lay down the quest. There can be no retreat or escape after failure in the White Warrens. The quest has already been bravely served. None who now lay it down need feel shame." Carefully, Quan said, "Do you turn back, High Lord?" "Ah, no," sighed Prothol. "The hand of these times is upon me. I dare not falter." Then Quan replied, "Can a yeoman of the Warword of Lords keep turn back when the High Lord leads?" "Never." And the yeoman echoed, "Never." Covenant wondered where Foam Follower was, what the giant would do. For himself, he felt intuitively sure that he had no choice, that his dream would only release him by means of the Staff of Law, or by death. The next moment, Main Thrall Lithe spoke to Prothol. Her head was back, and her slim form was primed as if she were prepared to explode. "I gave my word. Your horses will be tended. The cords will preserve them in hope of your return. But I..." She shook her bound hair as if she were defying herself. "I will go with you, under the ground." Prothol's protest she stopped with a sharp gesture. "You set an example I must follow. How could I stand before Araunahin again if I come so far only to turn away when the peril becomes great? And I feel something more. The Ramen know the sky, the open earth. We know air and grass. We do not lose our way in darkness. The Ranahin have taught our feet to be sure. I feel that I will always know my way outward. You may have need of me, though I am far from the plains of Ra and from myself." The shadows formed Prothol's face into a grimace, but he responded quietly, "I thank you, Main Thrall. The Ramen are brave friends of the land. Casting his eyes over the whole company, he said, Come, then. The outcome of our quest awaits. Whatever may befall us, as long as there are people to sing, they will sing that in this dark hour the land was well championed. Now, be true to the last. Without waiting for an answer, he went out of the bloody moonlight into the rift. The warriors let Covenant follow behind the two lords as if according him a position of respect. Prothol and Morum walked side by side, and when they neared the look, Covenant could see from between them Foam Follower standing at the edge of the cliff. The giant had his palms braced above his head on either wall. His back was to the lords. He stared into the bleak, blood-hued writhing of the river. His huge form was dark against the vermilion sky. When the lords came near him, he said as if he were speaking back to them from the gorge, I remain here. My watch. I will guard you. Drool's army will not trap you in Mount Thunder while I live. A moment later, he added as if he had recognized the bottom of himself, From here, I will not smell the white warrens. But his next words carried an echo of old giantish humor. The catacombs were not made to accommodate creatures the size of giants. You choose well, murmured Prothol. We need your protection. But do not remain here after the full moon. If we do not return by that time, we are lost, and you must go to warn your people. Foam Follower answered as if in reply to some other voice. Remember the oath of peace. In the maze where you go, it is your lifeline. It preserves you against Soul Crusher's purposes, hidden and savage. Remember the oath. It may be that hope misleads, but hate corrupts. I have been too quick to hate. I become like what I abhor. Have some respect for the truth, Morum snapped. The sudden harshness of his tone startled Covenant. You are Salt Heart Foam Follower of the Sea Reach Giants, Rock Brother to the men of the land. That name cannot be taken from you. But Covenant had heard no self-pity in the giant's words, only recognition and sorrow. Foam Follower did not speak again. He stood as still as the walls against which he braced himself, stood like a statue carved to occupy the look. The lord spent no more time with him. Already the night was waning, and they wanted to enter the mountain before daylight. The questers took positions. Prothol, Birinair, and two Bloodguard followed First Mark Tuvor. Then came Morum, Lithe, Banner, Covenant, and Korik. Then came Warhaft Quan, his 14 warriors, and the last 4 Bloodguard. They were only 29 against all of Drool Rockworm's unknown might. They strung a line of Klingor from Tuvor to the last Bloodguard. In single file, they started down the slick stair into Treacher's Gorge. Chapter 22. The Catacombs of Mount Thunder. Drool's moon embittered the night like a consummation of gall. Under it the river thrashed and roared in Treacher's Gorge as if it were being crushed. Spray and slick wet moss made the stair down from the look as treacherous as a quagmire. Covenant bristled with trepidations. At first, when his turn to begin the descent had come, his dread had paralyzed him. But when Banner had offered to carry him, he had found the pride to make himself move. In addition to the Klingor line, Banner and Korik held his staff like a railing for him. He went tortuously down into the gorge as if he were striving to lock his feet on the stone of each step. The stair dropped irregularly from the cliff into the wall of the gorge. Soon the company was creeping into the loud chasm, led only by the light of Birinair's torch. The crimson froth of the river seemed to leap up at them like a hungry plague as they neared the roadway. Each step was slicker than the one before. Behind him, Covenant heard a gasp as one of the warriors slipped. The low cry carried terror like the quarrel of a crossbow, but the blood guard anchoring the line were secure. The warrior quickly regained his footing. The descent dragged on. Covenant's ankles began to ache with the increasing uncertainty of his feet. He tried to think his souls into the rock, make them part of the stone through sheer concentration, and he gripped his staff until his palms were so slick with sweat that the wood seemed to be pulling away from him. His knees started to quiver. But Banner and Korik upheld him. The distance to the roadway shrank. After several long, bad moments, the threat of panic receded. Then he reached the comparative safety of the ledge. He stood in the midst of the company between the gorge wall and the channel of the river. Above them, the slash of sky had begun to turn gray, but that lightning only emphasized the darkness of the gorge. Birinair's lone torch flickered as if it were lost in a wilderland. The questers had to yell to make themselves understood over the tumult of the current. Briskly, Quan gave marching orders to his yeomen. The warriors checked over their weapons. With a few gestures and a slight nod or two, Tuvor made his last arrangements with the blood guard. Covenant gripped his staff and assured himself of his stone downer knife. Atiaran's knife. He had a vague impression that he had forgotten something. But before he could try to think what it was, he was distracted by shouts. Old Birinair was yelling at High Lord Prothol. For once, the Heartthrall seemed careless of his gruff dignity. Against the roar of the river, he thrust his seamed and quivering face at Prothol and barked, "You cannot! The risk!" Prothol shook his head negatively. "You cannot lead! Allow me!" Again, Prothol silently refused. "Of course," shouted Birinair, struggling to make his determination carry over the howl of water. "You must not. I can. I know the ways. Of course. Are you alone old enough to study? I know the old maps. No fool, you know. If I look old and..." He faltered momentarily. "And useless? You must allow me." Prothol strove to shout without sounding angry. "Time is short. We must not delay. Birinair, old friend, I cannot put the first risk of this quest on to another. It is my place." "Fool," spat Birinair, daring any insolence to gain his point. "How will you see?" "See? Of course." The Heartthrall quivered with sarcasm. "You will go before. Risk all. Light the way with Lord's fire. Fool! Druul will see you before you reach Warren Bridge." Prothol at last understood. "Ah, that is true." He sagged as if the realization hurt him. "Your light is quieter than mine. Druul will surely sense our coming if I make use of my staff." Abruptly he turned to one side, angry now. "Tuvor," he commanded. "Heartthrall Birinair leads. He will light our way in my place. Ward him well, Tuvor. Do not let this old friend suffer my perils." Birinair drew himself up, rediscovering dignity in his responsibility. He extinguished the rod he carried and gave it to a warrior to pack away with the rest of his brands. Then he stroked the end of his staff, and a flame sprang up there. With a brusque beckon, he raised his fire and started stiffly down the roadway toward the maw of Mount Thunder. At once, Terrell and Korik passed the Hirebrand and took scouting positions 20 feet ahead of him. Two other blood guard placed themselves just behind him, and after them went Prothol and Morum together. Then two more blood guard followed singly by main thrall Lithe, Covenant, and Banner. Next marched Quan with his yeomen in files of three, leaving the last two Bloodguard to bring up the rear. In that formation, the company moved toward the entrance to the catacombs. Covenant looked upward briefly to try to catch a last glimpse of Foam Follower in the look. But he did not see the giant. The gorge was too full of darkness, and the roadway demanded his attention. He went into the rock under Foam Follower without any wave or sign of farewell. Thus the company strode away from daylight, from sun and sky and open air and grass and possibility of retreat, and took their quest into the gullet of Mount Thunder. Covenant went into that domain of night as if into a nightmare. He was not braced for the entrance to the catacombs. He had approached it without fear. The relief of having survived the descent from the look had rendered him temporarily immune to panic. He had not said farewell to Foam Follower. He had forgotten something. But these pangs were diffused by a sense of anticipation, a sense that his bargain would bring him out of the dream with his ability to endure intact. But the sky above, an openness of which he had hardly been aware, was cut off as if by an axe and replaced by the huge stone weight of the mountain, so heavy that its aura alone was crushing. In his ears, its mass seemed to rumble like silent thunder. The river's roaring mounted in the gullet of the cave, adumbrated itself as if the constricted pain of the current were again constricted into keener and louder pain. The spray was as thick as rain. Ahead of the company, Birinair's flame burned dim and penumbral, nearly quenched by the wet air. And the surface of the roadway was hazardous, littered with holes and rocks and loose shale. Covenant strained his attention as if he were listening for a note of sense in the gibberish of his experience, and under this alertness he wore his hope of escape like a buckler. In more ways than one, he felt that it was his only protection. The company seemed pathetically weak, defenseless against the dark-dwelling cave-wights and Urviles. Stumbling through night broken only at the solitary point of Birinair's fire, he predicted that the company would be observed soon. Then a report would go to Druul, and the inner forces of the White Warrens would pour forth, and the army would be recalled. What chance had Foam Follower against so many thousands of cave-whites? And the company would be crushed like a handful of presumptuous ants. And in that moment of resolution or death would come his own rescue or defeat. He could not envision any other outcome. With these thoughts, he walked as if he were listening for the downward rush of an avalanche. After some distance, he realized that the sound of the river was changing. The roadway went inward almost horizontally, but the river was falling into the depths of the rock. The current was becoming a cataract, an abysmal plummet like a plunge into death. The sound of it receded slowly as the river crashed farther and farther away from the lip of the chasm. Now there was less spray in the air to dim Birinair's flame. With less dampness to blur it, the stone wall showed more of its essential granite. Between the wall and the chasm, Covenant clung to the reassurance of the roadway. When he put a foot down hard, he could feel the solidity of the ledge jolt from his heel to the base of his spine. Around him, the cave had become like a tunnel, except for the chasm on the left. He fought his apprehension by concentrating on his feet and the higher brand's flame. The river fell helplessly, and its roar faded like fingers scraping for a lost purchase. Soon he began to hear the moving noises of the company. He turned to try to see the opening of the gorge, but either the road had been curving gradually, or the opening had been lost in the distance. He saw nothing behind him but night, as unmitigated as the blackness ahead. But after a time he felt that the looming dark was losing its edge. Some change in the air attenuated the midnight of the catacombs. He stared ahead, trying to clarify the perception. No one spoke. The company hugged its silence as if in fear that the walls were capable of hearing. Shortly, however, Birinair halted. Covenant, Lithe, and the Lords quickly joined the old Hirebrand. With him stood Terrell. "Warren Bridge lies ahead," said the Bloodguard. "Korik watches. There are sentries." He spoke softly, but after the long silence his voice sounded careless of hazards.
"Ah, I feared that," whispered Prothol. "Can we approach?"
Rocklight makes dark shadows. The sentries stand atop the span. We can approach within bowshot. Morim called quietly for Quan while Prothol asked, "How many sentries?" Terrell replied, "Two."
"Only two?"
The Bloodguard shrugged fractionally. "They suffice. Between them lies the only entrance to the White Warrens." But Prothol breathed again,
"Only two."
He seemed to be groping to recognize a danger he could not see. While the High Lord considered, Morim spoke rapidly to Quan. At once, the warhalf turned to his yeoman, and shortly two warriors stood by Terrell, unslinging their bows. They were tall, slim woodhelvenin, and in the pale light their limbs hardly looked brawny enough to bend their stiff bows. For a moment longer, Prothol hesitated, pulling at his beard as if he were trying to tug a vague impression into consciousness. But then he thrust his anxiety down, gave Terrell a sharp nod. Briskly, the Bloodguard led the two warriors away toward the attenuated night ahead. Prothol whispered intently to the company, "Have a care. Take no risk without my order. My heart tells me there is peril here. Some strange danger which Kevin's lore names, but now I cannot recall it. Ah, memory. That knowledge is so dim and separate from what we have known since the desecration. Think, all of you. Take great care." Walking slowly, he went forward beside Birinair, and the company followed. Now the light became steadily clearer, an orange-red, rocky glow like that which Covenant had seen long ago in his brief meeting with Druul in Kirill Threndor. Soon the questers could see that in a few hundred yards the cave took a sharp turn to the right, and at the same time the ceiling of the tunnel rose as if there were a great vault beyond the bend. Before they had covered half the distance, Korik joined them to guide them to a safe vantage. On the way, he pointed out the position of Terrell and the two warriors. They had climbed partway up the right wall and were kneeling on a ledge in the angle of the bend. Korik led the company close to the river cleft until they reached a sheer stone wall. The chasm appeared to leave them, vanish straight into the rock which turned the road toward the right, but light shone over this rock as well as through the chasm. The rock was not a wall, but rather a huge boulder sitting like a door ajar before the entrance to an immense chamber. Terrell had taken the two warriors to a position from which they could fire their shafts over this boulder. Korik guided Prothol, Morim, and Covenant across the shadow cast by the boulder until they could peer to the left around its edge. Covenant found himself looking into a high, flat-floored cavern. The chasm of the river swung around behind the boulder and cut at right angles to its previous direction straight through the center of the vault, then disappeared into the far wall. So the roadway went no farther along the river's course, but there were no other openings in the outer half of the cavern. At that point, the chasm was at least 50 feet wide. The only way across it was a massive bridge of native stone which filled the middle of the vault. Carefully, Morim whispered, "Only two. They are enough. Pray for a true aim. There will be no second chance." At first, Covenant saw no guards. His eyes were held by two pillars of pulsing, fiery rocklight which stood like sentries on either side of the bridge crest. But he forced himself to study the bridge, and shortly he discerned two black figures on the span, one beside each pillar. They were nearly invisible, so close to the rocklight.
"Urviles," the High Lord muttered. "By the Seven, I must remember. Why are they not cave whites? Why does Druul waste Ervyles on such duty?
Covenant hardly listened to Prothol's uneasiness. The rocklight demanded his attention. It seemed to hold affinities for him that he could not guess. By some perverse logic of its pulsations, he felt himself made aware of his wedding band. The droolish, powerful glow made his hand itch around his ring like a reminder that its promise of cherishing had failed. Grimly, he clenched his fist. Prothol gripped himself, said heavily to Koryk, "Make the attempt. We can only fail." Without a word, Koryk nodded up at Terrell. Together, two bowstrings thrummed flatly. The next instant, the Ervyles were gone. Covenant caught a glimpse of them dropping like black pebbles into the chasm. The High Lord sighed his relief. Morum turned away from the vault, threw a salute of congratulation toward the two archers, then hurried back to give explanations and orders to the rest of the company. From the yeomen came low murmured cheers and the noises of a relaxation of battle tension.
"Do not lower your guard," Prothol hissed. "The danger is not past. I feel it."
Covenant stood where he was, staring into the rocklight, clenching his fist. Something that he did not understand was happening.
"Urlord," Prothol asked softly, "what do you see?"
"Power."
The interruption irritated him. His voice scraped roughly in his throat.
"Druul's got enough to make you look silly."
He raised his left fist.
"It's daylight outside."
His ring burned blood red, throbbed to the pulse of the rocklight. Prothol frowned at the ring, concentrating fiercely. His lips were taut over his teeth as he muttered,
"This is not right. I must remember. Rocklight cannot do this."
Morum approached and said, before he saw what was between Covenant and Prothol,
"Terrell has rejoined us. We are ready to cross."
Prothol nodded inattentively. Then Morum noticed the ring. Covenant heard a sound as if Morum were grinding his teeth. The Lord reached out, clasped his hand over Covenant's fist. A moment later, he turned and signaled to the company. Quan led his yeoman forward with the blood guard. Prothol looked distracted, but he went with Birinair into the vault. Automatically, Covenant followed them toward the Warren Bridge. Tuvor and another blood guard went ahead of the High Lord. They neared the bridge, inspecting it to be sure that the span was truly safe before the lords crossed. Covenant wandered forward as if in a trance. The spell of the rocklight grew on him. His ring began to feel hot. He had to make an effort of consciousness to wonder why his ring was bloody rather than orange-red like the glowing pillars. But he had no answer. He felt a change coming over him that he could not resist or measure or even analyze. It was as if his ring were confusing his senses, turning them on their pivots to peer into unknown dimensions. Tuvor and his comrades started up the bridge. Prothol held the company back, despite the inherent danger of remaining in the open light. He stared after Tuvor and yanked at his beard with a hand which trembled agedly. Covenant felt the spell mastering him. The cavern began to change. In places, the rock walls seemed thinner, as if they were about to become transparent. Quan and Lithe and the warriors grew transparent as well, approached the evanescence of wraiths. Prothol and Morum appeared solider, but Prothol flickered where Morum was steady. Only the blood guard showed no sign of dissipating, of losing their essence in mist. The blood guard and the ring. Covenant's own flesh now looked so vague that he feared his ring would fall through it to the stone. At his shoulder, Banor stood, hard, implacable, and dangerous, as if the blood guard's mere touch might scatter his beclouded being to the winds. He was drifting into transience. He tried to clench himself. His fingers came back empty. Tuvor neared the crest of the span. The bridge seemed about to crumble under him. He appeared so much solider than the stone. Then Covenant saw it. A loop of shimmering air banded around the center of the bridge, standing flat across the roadway and around under the span and back. He did not know what it was, understood nothing about it, except that it was powerful. Tuvor was about to step into it. With an effort like a convulsion, Covenant started to fight, resist the spell. Some intuition told him that Tuvor would be killed. Even a leper, he adjured himself. This was not his bargain. He had not promised to stand silent and watch men die. Hellfire! Then, with recovered rage, he cried again, Hellfire! Stop, he gasped. Can't you see? At once, Prothol shouted, Tuvor, do not move! Wheeling on Covenant, he demanded, What is it? What do you see? The violence of his rage brought back some of the solidity to his vision, but Prothol still appeared dangerously evanescent. Covenant jerked up his ring, spat, Get them down! Are you blind? It's not the rock light. Something else up there. Morum recalled Tuvor and his companion. But for a moment, Prothol only stared in blank fear at Covenant. Then, abruptly, he struck his staff on the stone and ejaculated, Ur-vials, and rocklight, just there, as anchors. Ah, I am blind, blind. They tend the power. Incredulously, Morum whispered, A word of warning? Yes. Is it possible? Has Drool entirely mastered the staff? Can he speak such might? Prothol was already on his way toward the bridge. Over his shoulder he replied, He has Lord Foul to teach him. We have no such help. A moment later he strode up the span with Tuvor close behind him. The spell reached for Covenant again, but he knew it better now and held it at bay with curses. He could still see the shimmering loop of the word as Prothol neared it. The High Lord approached slowly and at last halted a step before the word. Gripping his staff in his left hand, he held his right arm up with the palm forward like a gesture of recognition. With a rattling cough, he began to sing. Constantly repeating the same motif, he sang cryptically in a language Covenant did not understand. A language so old that it sounded grizzled and hoary. Prothol sang it softly, intimately, as if he were entering into private communion with the word of warning. Gradually, vaguely, like imminent mist, the word became visible to the company. In the air opposite Prothol's palm, an indistinct shred of red appeared, coalesced like a fragment of an unseen tapestry. The pale, hanging red expanded until a large, rough circle was centered opposite his palm. With extreme caution, singing all the while, he raised his hand to measure the height of the word, moved sideways to judge its configuration. Thus, in tatters, the company saw the barrier which opposed them. And as Covenant brought more of himself to the pitch of his stiff rage, his own perception of the word paled until he saw only as much of it as the others did. At last, Prothol lowered his hand and ceased his song. The shreds vanished. He came tightly down the bridge as if he were only holding himself erect by the simple strength of his resolution. But his gaze was full of comprehension and the measure of risks. A word of warning, he reported sternly. Set here by the power of the staff of law to inform Drool if his defenses were breached, and to break Warren Bridge at the first touch. His tone carried a glimpse of a plunge into the chasm. It is a work of great power. No lord since the desecration has been capable of such a feat, and even if we had the might to undo it, we would gain nothing. For Drool would be warned. Still, there is one sign in our favor. Such a word cannot be maintained without constant attention. It must be tended, else it decays.
though not speedily enough for our purpose. The drool set Ervile's here as sentries perhaps shows that his mind is elsewhere. Wonderful, Covenant growled corrosively. Terrific. His hands itched with an intense urge to throttle someone. Prothol continued, If Drool's eyes are turned away, it may be that we